and continue on here dealing with the subject of spiritual gifts. The one we are dealing with largely at the moment is giving. And again, while an individual believer, each has his own primary gift, this is one that's clearly taught that all believers have a responsibility under which to function. And so God obviously honors this, as he honors the function of all gifts, but again, they are designed to function towards other believers, primarily in the local church, although not exclusively. We see that in the commands in Scripture that we have commands to function primarily towards those in our periphery, but we also have commands to function towards those on the outside. They are not going to be the general beneficiaries of our lives and of our function as believers, but they can certainly benefit from it. So dealing with giving, again, each believer has a gift. Someone may have this. If a person has this, they tend to be generous. That just tends to be, that's how this thing manifests itself. And that's not to say that there can't be people that are generous that don't have this gift. But like all the gifts, you should seek to function in a maximum way under this. But again, one of the things you have to watch for would be to give when it was inappropriate, to an inappropriate cause or in an inappropriate time. We were down here now to point 9. Those with this gift must never use their place in God's plan to attempt to control another believer's life or the ministry of some communicator by giving or withholding funds. That would certainly be a big maladjustment to this. If God provides you a gift and then you say, well, I'm not going to function under it because I'm going to teach so-and-so a lesson. Well, that is assuming authority that you don't have. God didn't give you the gift for that purpose, as he didn't give any of the gifts for that purpose. They're designed to serve. 10, one with this gift may function well under it by being frugal with himself. Alternately, one may also rationalize his generosity with himself, his STA lunging, based on his generosity with others. So some people, there are two extremes you could have here. A person may have this gift, and in order to manage it, they see the importance of functioning under it in a spiritual sense. They see the importance of giving, of helping other believers and all of that, supporting the local church. And they manage that by cheating themselves, in a sense, or cheating their family. That would be one extreme you would want to avoid. There's a place for not pursuing things. There's a place for being content with what you've got. The Bible's very plain on this. Paul said, I've learned how to be in abundance, and I've learned how to be in need. And the way you learn these things is by going through them. So there's a place for frugality at a certain level, and a place for a budget, and a place for living within your means. Then again, there's a place for enjoying what God provides. And each believer has to find this balance on their own. Given the nature of Babylon, the place where we live, given the nature of our country and all of that, most people tend towards the other, towards pursuing things, towards making sure they always have the highest and the best, and they don't tend to be frugal with themselves. That's not necessarily appropriate. You have to find a balance in these things in your niche and work out your own salvation in this regard with fear and trembling. The other extreme I've seen is that some people are truly generous and probably have this gift and function under it. And then they rationalize their own desire to go out and buy everything they want and see because they say, well, I'm generous with God's plan, therefore I deserve the best. That doesn't follow logically either. That would be another extreme, that you lunge and cater to yourself and all based on, well, I give at a high level, so therefore I deserve this. No. No, that doesn't follow logically either. You can't, again, those would both be extremes. 11, this gift has been abused in fundamentalist circles by either taking advantage of it, of those who with it, or by exalting it, those with it, beyond the other gifts. This gift is no more important than others. But given the nature of our society, and given the value that people place on money and details, you can see where this person would be looked at in an exceedingly kind way. Because they do tend to be generous. They do tend to be charitable. And so, but again, they have to prioritize just like all believers do. Let's say God really blessed you. It doesn't mean he wants you supporting 90 different things, though, necessarily either. Even if you have this gift and you function under it. Primarily, your first responsibility is to support the teaching of the truth here. Now, my contention is, and you can think through this on your own, but my contention is, until the pastor here's on full maintenance, we don't have any real business engaging in an ongoing financial responsibility outside this church. We have things that we have to have here, toner, and, you know, from time to time we had to buy, I think we bought two copiers in 15 years, and you have to have toner and paper and all of that. But those are really, we really limit expenses as much as we can. We tend to be frugal. If anything, we have to pay the Department of State once a year for your, you know, nonprofit corporation. You have to post that report. So other than that, though, we don't tend to spend money on anything we don't have to. So primarily, my contention is, again, and this was a bone of contention when I first started here, people want to send money off to 9 different things while I'm working a full-time job out here lugging cabinets around in the 110-degree heat index, and they want to support some missionary in Africa. What? Are you insane? I don't see that as being appropriate. Sure, there's millions of needs in the world. How are you going to ever decide which ones to approach? That's why you have to prioritize. And again, the local church can't become so self-centered that it's just all about the local church and nothing else. There's a time and a place for helping others, and we have. When Ken's wife died, we sent an offering up to them to help them out financially. When Tom's house burned up on Long Island, we sent an offering for that, too. And but, you know, other than that, other than an extreme situation that's an emergency, certainly we can see beyond, okay, this is an emergency and all of that. Primarily, this is where the function is to be. So, again, we're not going to exalt this person, again, beyond the other gifts. They've got it, fine. We would tend to say low-key it, in fact. 12, the one with this gift must fight the tendency to be stingy or grudging, since the one whose gift is giving must function with liberality. 13, this gift is a private parts gift and is not to be paraded before the church. It is analogous to the genitals. What we encourage you in your dress is to keep your genitals covered. We insist on it, in fact. Please do not come to church naked. Wear clothing. And we'll get into that more in chapter 2, what appropriate clothing is even. But this is like giving. See, giving's not to be exalted and paraded around and all of that. And that's why we tend to low-key it. We take up offerings, and if somebody wants to give to a certain thing and they designate an offering, we handle all that. The board handles it through, the treasurer handles it, and the offering goes to where it's meant to be. We had that happen recently. Somebody designated an offering for something. It went right with what they sent it to. And that's appropriate. And so we don't, you know, we don't stand up and say, oh, you know, when we pass the basket, I don't stand up here. I got a 50, who'll match it? Oh, I've seen that. You laugh, but I've seen that. you know, and I'll never forget when I would, you know, I'm this poor little church mouse living at First Southern, and you know the pastor there's making 60 or 70,000 a year, and he's wanting to know, you know, he was wanting to buy a new building, get a new bigger building, a monument to himself, and so he asked us in a staff meeting one day. I mean, I'm making like $400 a month at that time. This was in like 78 or 79, somewhere in there, and $400 still didn't go very far then, but it went farther than it does today. And he was like, how many of you can get a loan if you need to get up to $10,000? I just burst out laughing. What? I just burst out. I mean, he didn't think it was funny either. He was deadly serious. And so, again, we don't, if you got a gift or if you give, we encourage you to do it on your own, quietly, privately. We're not going to make a big deal out of it. You're not supposed to. And that's why, if anything, if we've low-keyed this issue, maybe it's been to our detriment. I don't know. I deal with it when it comes up in the notes or when it comes up in the text. It's not as though I'm afraid to talk about giving. At first, though, I remember when I first came down here, I mean, I just thought it was a crime to mention it. And that's a wrong attitude, too. The pastor can't be afraid to get up and deal with a spiritual issue that's critical to the life of the congregation because the fundies have abused it. Well, for God's sake, we couldn't deal with a lot of things then. And this would be one of them. Well, the next one is leading. One, this person has the spiritual gift of leading, is motivated to help others by taking charge of some organization, project, etc., and bring it to a successful conclusion. Two, the person with this gift can see the task before the group and all that will be necessary to accomplish that task. Three, he can recognize the resources he has, be they financial, physical, or human resources, and is effectively able to marshal the things at his disposal to get the job done. And when a person sees there's a need, and the person is motivated to meet it, and that involves organizing other believers, who in the world would dissuade them from doing that? I mean, that is goofball. Somebody sees an application that ought to be made and tries to organize it and get it done. I, for one, if I was out there in the congregation, I would want to cooperate with this person. I mean, part of Beast Barracks is when you go to seminary, you don't just go to seminary and, you know, you do the disciplines of the languages and isagogics and hermeneutics and systematic theology and Hebrew and Greek and all that. Part of it is you have to function in a local church. And so, like all believers out there, I had to plug in and apply somewhere. So I plugged in the tape room. That's where I applied. Nobody had to tell me to do this. I could figure it out on my own. The teaching was clear enough at that point that I could just look at it and say, well, all right, see, I'm here. I'm no better than anybody. I've got to sit out here. And so that's another part of Beast Barracks, is you got to sit out there for however long it was. In my case, it was 6 years. And humble yourself and listen to another guy teach, knowing you could do it. Well, after the 3 years, I could do it, but not the first three. But then you sit there and you know I could do this and all of that. Well, I plugged in to apply, and, you know, I exhorted people around me, you know, hey, you want to apply in this area? You want to help? And so they would do it. Some of them, some did, some didn't. Obviously, it has to be up to the believer's choice. But a person that's got this gift is able to organize people. And there's nothing wrong with organizing believers for a particular purpose. That you see a project is bigger than one guy could do. And that's fine. I mean, I've done, and while I was at Maranatha even, there was a particular situation I felt inclined to apply towards. There was this pastor that hadn't had a vacation in several years, and I took it upon myself to try to get everything that was necessary so he could have a vacation, which included some money and other things. And I exhorted, you know, I asked other believers to help me apply, and, you know, we pulled the thing off. Well, it's just a little deal. That's not critically important. But there's nothing wrong with that at a certain level. You say, well, that violates the privacy of the priesthood. No, you have the right to say no. Nobody's forcing you to do anything. But that's an extreme, in my opinion, that nobody ever has the right to ask anybody to do anything because that violates their priesthood, their privacy. No, it doesn't. They can say no. And as we would exhort people, if you say no, if it's not your God's will for you to function in that niche or to do that, well, then fine. Recognize it and, you know, don't feel intimidated by saying no. Okay, no, I don't feel inclined to apply in that area. And this is where if you're trying to organize something or you have this gift and God's blessing you, he'll probably lead you to the right people. But there, you may run into some dead ends. And that's fine, too. So don't let that discourage you. If you're trying to organize something or to motivate people to get something done, some may want to do it, some may not, for whatever reasons, probably right and wrong reasons. I don't assume all believers always have the correct motivation, but I don't always either assume that they don't. I assume, you know, it can be a mixture. So you try to organize things, and again, this probably has to be a bigger project. And one, if it was a quick, short project, a person with the gift of serving probably would have handled it. So there's ongoing things that need to be done. So you got to recognize what your resources are and what you need for the job in order to get it done. Five, this type of believer is able to commit to a task and overcome whatever. I skipped one here. Four, this person must be one that knows when and how to delegate authority. He must distinguish what he needs to do personally and what can be done safely or safely can be entrusted to others. And that's a real art form. That's a real thing to learn in life, that there's a time to delegate and there's a time not to. There's a time when if you don't do it, it doesn't get done. And the fact is you have to recognize when those times are. And then sometimes when you delegate, other people drop the ball. Let's face it. You might delegate authority and say, get thus and such done, and they look you in the eye and they say, you can count on me. Translated, I'll probably screw you over on this. But hopefully they won't, but I mean, that can happen. So you have to recognize, again, that at a certain level you're functioning with whatever authority you might have. Maybe you're just organizing something with, as it were, with very little authority to back you up. But you think it needs to be done, and you're motivated. And assuming it's, you know, something legit, we're going to assume it's legit, that it's not that. So you got to know how and when and where to delegate. It would be nice if I could delegate authority to exegesis to somebody else. All the donkey work, I could just delegate that out. You do this, you do this, you study this word and get back with me. That doesn't work, however, unfortunately. So you have to know when and where you can. Five, this type of believer is able to commit to a task and overcome whatever problems, opposition, etc., that may come his way in the course of completing his assignment. And that's another factor. Don't assume, like any of the gifts should not assume, that the angelic conflict's just going to roll over on you and just let you, oh, well, they're functioning under their gift. I don't care. No, I would assume you will encounter satanic opposition or demonic opposition. Our unseen enemies are not just going to say, oh, well, that's fine, they're applying. In fact, the tone will probably be the opposite. Let's see if we can get them to quit. Let's get them to quit applying. So again, you're going to run into problems. And anybody that's ever done, like say you got in charge of a remodel project somewhere. And as you know, every time you turn the corner on a remodel project, there's something new you didn't anticipate. And that you're going to encounter that. And so the person that can lead is able to overcome those things. He doesn't let them get him down. He's like, okay, there's just another obstacle, fine. It's just another thing God can overcome for us. And he's committed to it. Six, since he clearly sees the goal, he is able to quickly evaluate requests, make firm decisions, and stick to them. That doesn't always make him popular. A person that's in charge of, say, organizing something may say, you do this. Well, I don't want to do that. Well, I want you to. I mean, you signed up to apply. Now here's what I want you to do. And so it's a test of their humiliation and orientation to authority, at whatever level the person has authority in that regard. If they're a deacon and they're put in charge of a project, we want to get this project done. And then we ask for volunteers, as we always do. We've never here at this local church just thrown stuff on people. We've always asked for people to apply. We don't run around assigning tasks to you. And we're not going to. That's not the way to go. That to me, is a violation of your priesthood. You have the right to figure out, we can make an announcement, if you want to. Maybe you're motivated to apply in a certain area. Maybe God's blessing you to apply in a certain area, and maybe he wouldn't. And you have to be sensitive to that. Okay, I can see that's not for me. You know, I can see that, you know, my niche is not to work in the nursery, or my niche is not to teach in the prep school, or my niche is not to work on the grounds crew, or whatever. That's not for me. This is where you got to allow believers the freedom to figure it out and apply on their own. Seven, this type of person is very detail-oriented and recognizes the difference between a job merely done and a job done well is found in attention to the details. If you are ever in charge of anything, if God blesses you in this regard, do the job right. Don't just slap it together with glue and duct tape. I mean, find out what it takes to do the job right and do it right. If we do anything, we want it to look good when you're done. You want to be proud of the finished product. You don't want to just look at it and say, oh, well, they got it done all right. But I wouldn't want that in my house. It shouldn't be that way. Eight, since this type of believer is largely dependent upon the cooperation of those under his authority, he may become disillusioned or disheartened when others fail to apply as he thinks or knows they should. In that regard, in any position of leadership, people are going to let you down. This is a fundamental rule of any leadership. People are going to fail under your authority. They're not going to always apply like they ought to. And you can't let that get to you. At a certain level, you just have to say, you know what? I can't. That's between them and the Lord. And they have to sort that out. It's not my responsibility to make everyone apply. And there are people that, you know, you can consistently count on. All I got to do is pick up the phone. I know they'll be there. And there are other people where you just wonder, well, I could call them, but I don't know. And so if people fail, as they will, the job isn't over. You know, the task isn't finished. So don't be disillusioned. Don't be disheartened. Don't give up. Nehemiah, in that regard, and I don't know if I dealt with that in here. I hope I did. No, I didn't. I should have, though. If you read the book of Nehemiah, sometime on your own, I'm not going to stop and read it now, but if you read it on your own, Nehemiah had a big task and a big project to do with the rebuilding there in Jerusalem. And he's a good example of what a leader does and how he functions. And he recognized the attacks that were coming from the enemies. He recognized when his people were getting disheartened. He recognized when he was flagging. He recognized all kinds of things. And he's a really good example of how to get a job done. That's a book worth reading on your own. You might, you know, there are parts of it you probably will think are tedious, but that book really shows what a good leader's like. 9, since he requires loyalty and faithfulness to complete his work, he may become guilty of partiality or favoritism towards those that he deems more necessary. He must be careful not to view workers on the basis of their ability to get the job done, or he may be reluctant to dismiss one that has some obvious problems. Which essentially communicates approval of their actions to others. If somebody's really failing, at a certain point there's a time to stand up and say, you know, you're dropping the ball and I'm tired of it. And if the person says, well, I don't want to apply anymore, that's fine. Get out. You know, go. I'm not here to force you into applying. There's a time and a place to address shortcomings and failures towards those you lead. And that isn't every day. It isn't at every moment. You have to pick your battles, too. Any good leader, any good parent knows, anybody with any level of authority knows this. You've got to pick your battles. If you let everything become World War III, you're not going to be an effective leader. And so those who have this ability to administrate, it's a real art form. And obviously it's a great blessing in a local church to have the ability to administrate. At a certain level, one of the things you see is that many, many of these things are required for the pastor. He's got to know when to delegate, when not to. He's got to know how to administrate. You want to get the most out of people, but you don't want to feel like you're just using them, because that's not what we're here for. 10, the man in charge tends to give orders without always explaining them, so others may begin to get the idea that they are merely pawns in the operation and not really appreciated or respected. And such is not the case. This is the value, and every believer should understand this. The Bible is very plain that each one of us brings something unique to God's plan, that we're here for a reason. And that unique thing we bring, everybody should be appreciated for who they are. At whatever level of spiritual growth they may be right at this moment is in some ways irrelevant. That they are still here, they are still plugged in, that at whatever level they apply, they apply. And that's not to say there's never a time for exhortation and saying, come on, some of you aren't applying very well. Some of you rationalize things away. But the people ought to recognize they're not just pawns in the organization. They're important to it. Every believer is important to the local church. I mean, what bodily part do you want to be without today? I think I'm going to prefer to keep all mine. You know, I don't want to be missing my hands later. I might need them to fix lunch or something. I'm going to need my feet to get out to the car. I'm going to need my eyes to drive. I'm going to need my brain to make decisions. I'm going to need my heart so I don't just go out there and kill anybody that gets in my way. You know, some compassion and all that. So I wouldn't want to be without any part of the body. So everybody's important. Everybody plugs in. Everybody's valuable. And any organization that doesn't, well, of course, a local church, this is obvious, I think, just from the fundamental nature of, you know, how valuable believers are. But any organization, if you feel like you're just there and you're just a cog, you know, another brick in the wall, well, that doesn't leave you with much in the way of motivation, does it? So 11, and again, this guy, the point is, too, that when you give authority or when you have it, and this is something people need to know, you don't always have to stop and explain yourself. You don't. In some cases, you don't have time to. You're off to the next thing. You've got multiplicity of things you got to do. And we're not, again, suggesting that there's not a time and a place for politeness and please and thank you. But in some cases, there's no time for that, really. And if you're going to get your feelings hurt, oh, he didn't say please. Like in that movie, Pulp Fiction. Could you say please? I'm here to help you. You got a dead body in a car, right? You need help. I'm not here to say please and thank you. I'm here to try to keep you from prison. And I cite that as kind of a funny example, but the fact is, you try to be polite and all that. But in a position of leadership, you don't always have to be. And if you're going to get your feelings hurt every time somebody isn't polite to you, well, then you're going to walk around with your feelings hurt a lot, because this world is not a polite place. Not as much. I mean, and it varies even where you are. People are way more polite, you know, say in Oklahoma City than they are here. I can tell you that. And that's just a cultural thing, you know, but you're in the buckle of the Bible Belt. These people think you should be nice. Whereas in Sarasota, you know, I've moved down here from Canada. I don't care. What difference does it make? So, again, we don't encourage people to just run roughshod over people, but people have to recognize, too, the guy in charge doesn't always have to stop and explain himself. He may have very good reasons for why he's doing what he's doing, and you just have to exercise some faith and move on. And if he doesn't and he ends up with egg all over his face, how did that hurt you? Didn't hurt you to be obedient. 11, since he has authority over other believers, or has to exercise it at any rate, he must never lose sight of the fact that he is under the authority of the royal chain of command and begin to see himself as his own ultimate authority. This is the danger, particularly for men. Women tend to understand the whole authority thing better because they got that extra authority in their husband. And the women that have children in the home certainly begin to figure out authority because they recognize, I've got to have some obedience, or, you know, I can't function. And so, but men tend to be more lost to themselves sometimes. It's natural nature. I understand that. But you don't become a law to yourself. None of these gifts can afford to do that. You have to function within the parameters that God has established. And I'm not going to micromanage you. If you feel like there's some project you want to take on and you want to organize other believers to do it and it's appropriate, I'm fine. I don't have any problem with it. I don't have any problem with people showing initiative. Initiative is a good thing. Well, 12, this gift functions within the body in the, quote, organizational or head capacity. This is a, kind of the decision-making part of the body in some regards as he leads and organizes. Well, in mercy, the motivation for this believer, or believer with this gift, is to help other believers by sharing their pain or sorrow, by bearing their burdens with them. And again, while not, while it is a spiritual gift, certain people are really blessed at this, it is commanded of all of us, as again, all these gifts are. So just because you don't have, quote, I don't have the gift of mercy, so I can run roughshod over people. That's not my deal. No. You're still on the hook to bear people's burdens and to show mercy and all that. Galatians 6:2, bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. That is, and there's two things here. If you look ahead in verse 5, for each one shall bear his own load. Now, are we to bear each other's burdens, or are we each responsible to bear our own load? Well, the answer is both. Number one, there's two different words in the Greek for this. But the idea here is that each one of us has a personal responsibility in the local church to function and to be a blessing to the church at large. This involves things like setting up, tearing down, functioning in the prep school, teaching, working in the nursery, all these types of things. Some of the physical aspects of the church. All of us have a responsibility. In terms of giving, all of us have a responsibility. That you're not to just come here and get doctrine for free and say, well, that's good. They believe in grace giving. I get all my doctrine for free. Well, that's good. Somebody else is bearing your part of the load then. You're not off the hook with respect to that. And the same thing's true with other areas of application. Every believer ought to be saying, you know, I can point to something tangible I do around the local church to help it out, whatever it may be. And if you can't, then you need to start thinking about this. Well, why aren't I contributing? Because you have a responsibility to shoulder your burden of the load. And in some cases, after 15, 16, 17 years, I feel at this point that I've set enough of a good example in regard to this stuff that everybody ought to have figured it out by now. Now, obviously, there's new people, and they might not say, well, I haven't seen you set a good example. Well, you'll have to take my word for it, I guess. But I bear my share of the load, and in some cases more than my share of the load. But that's fine. That's my niche. That's what God's. That's what the plan of God is. But each one of us has a responsibility within the local church to contribute, not just financially either, with prayer and with other factors of physical things that you can do and all of that. Showing hospitality. I mean, there's all kinds of things, all kinds of applications a believer can make. So Galatians 6:2, though, bear one another's burdens. Then, outside of that, not only do you have the responsibility to bear your own burden, your own piece of this thing, but that's true in any organization. You have a responsibility to help other believers when they need it. As it were, to get under it and help them lift when either their strength is flagging or their burden becomes too big. And so you have to be sort of sensitive to this. This is a part of mercy, being sensitive to it. Oh, that believer's suffering. That believer's struggling. And in many cases, right or wrong, I'll just tell you how it is. In many cases, I know some of you struggle and some of you suffer, and I'm aware of it, and I pray for you. I don't necessarily run up to you and try to say, hey, what's wrong? How you doing? Because I feel like you should have some time and space and privacy under your own niche, and I don't need to address every issue or every time I think you're flagging. But I'm aware of it. It's not lost on me. Now, maybe another pastor, he'd run up to you and do it that other way. I don't know. But really, is that what you'd want? Every time the pastor sensed something was wrong in your life, how you doing? You okay? Well, that's not me in the first place. And I don't know that I see that as appropriate either. I can communicate my concern for you from the pulpit. If you need anything, you know you can pick up the phone and call me. Speaking of which, I got a new number I need to put out, so I'm going to see about getting rid of my landline, but I'm not sure if I will yet. But I'll give you the new number so you can call, you can use it, which I don't know right now. I do, but it's not in my head. Again, it's not as though I'm not merciful or don't care. Don't misinterpret my aloofness sometimes as, well, he's just not interested. Oh, I'm interested. I think 17 years of doing this would prove I'm interested, that I'm not in it for me. But no pastor can really afford to be if he's going to do it right. So, but if you need to talk to me and you say, well, geez, I wish Ron would, show some attention to me or something. I do, to the extent that I think it's appropriate. But I don't want to be a meddler either. I've seen pastors that do that. You want to maintain a balance. So if you think, well, Ron, I need more personal attention, call me and tell me, and then at least I'll know. And then the ball's in my court. I need to talk to you more regularly. Okay, fine. Well, I'll make time. I have plenty of time. I don't have plenty of time, but I've got time. And I've got time for anybody here anytime. With this gift, have the knack of knowing when one is suffering some mental or emotional distress, or physically. It's not as though they can't be suffering physically as well. 3, this gift has the ability to sense when people are hurting and desire to enter into their suffering. There are people who they have this knack, this ability, this gift, that they really are concerned about other people, and they want to show it in a tangible way. I've seen people, if they don't have this gift, it would surprise me. I mean, they're very nurturing and caring, and I mean, almost to the point where you're thinking, ooh, no, you want people like that. I mean, can you imagine a body that, where there was no concern, no compassion? I can't. Now, that's not all of us. Some of us tend to be more direct and abrasive, and then there's those kind, nice people, and you got to have them all. A believer that is spiritually merciful may cause those that are hurting or suffering to be drawn to them. There are certain people at certain times. Maybe you'll just function under this gift. God wants you to help a certain person, and they come to you out of the blue for whatever reason. And you talk to them, and you're some big encouragement to them at that point. And that's great. 5, one with the gift of exhortation may seek to explain the benefit of the pain and suffering. But one with the gift of mercy will desire to share in and or seek to remove the suffering. I mean, they would like people not to suffer. At a certain level, again, I function under this gift. It's not my primary gift. I don't like seeing people suffer. I don't think normal people do like seeing people suffer. But we have to recognize, on the other hand, that suffering is a part of God's plan, a big part of it. By many tribulations and pressures, we're going to enter into the kingdom of God. There's no verse that says, well, this is just going to be a cakewalk in the park. There's a lot of verses that indicate it's going to be difficult, it's going to be challenging, it's a race. You can be disqualified. You got to play by the rules. There's going to be pressures from within and without. You got the constant internal pressure of that everyday battle of between the STA and the Holy Spirit. Battling it out inside of you to see who's going to rule. And we give in to the STA, and he gets in position of power, and he rules for a while, and isn't that fun? No. Ultimately, that doesn't make you happy, so you get back in fellowship. But the battle rages all the time, and there's lulls in it, I understand, but it's ongoing. Then you got the external pressure of the cosmos trying to squeeze you into its mold. You need to be like us. Get your nasal next week. Now I've got talking bees in my sleep. For God's sake, you talk about brainwashing. And I don't even have allergies, and I want to go get some of this stuff. So, you got the cosmos trying to wear you down. You got the unseen enemies, the demons out there, pounding on you when they get the chance, as God lets them. And so we recognize that, yeah, people are going to, as you're going through this, you're going to hurt sometimes. I'm not a huge fan of R.E.M., but I did like that song, Everybody Hurts. I mean, it happens. This is a part of the Christian life. You're going to have days where you would just as soon just chuck it as anything else. I mean, you're going to look at God. I mean, I remember that night when I had the kidney stone. Whew, you did not want to hear how I was talking to God. I was nicer to the nurse the next day than I was to God. I had more than a few things to say to him. But that's a part of it. We're all going to suffer, whether it's physically. That was a physical suffering. But mentally, emotionally, you get stressed. And I'm glad there's those people around that genuinely care and are concerned and express it that they do. I like that. And when I'm really suffering, that's the kind of person I'd like to be around. I mean, you can really see the benefit of this, I would hope. Well, 6, those with this gift often find it difficult to be firm with people, since they would not want to do anything that would cause anyone pain or suffering. And so that's one of the occupational hazards of this gift. You can be so meek and mild and concerned that you miss some of the greater spiritual issues involved. This person may be suffering for reasons of their own making. God may not want you to be counseling them, as it were, with comfort. Again, you have to, like all of these things, you have to pray about it. Have to be led by the Spirit. 7, people that with this gift do not like suffering or conflict, who really does, and can seek to avoid separation or other doctrines that are unpleasant, wanting believers to be happy. But we have to recognize that happiness comes through orientation to the truth, not through just getting rid of unpleasant things. There are people in this world who have gotten rid, they've got the money, the time, the wherewithal, to rid themselves of all unpleasant things. Are they happy, though? The correct answer is, in many cases, no. If I had the money to unlimited time and funds, and I could get up every morning, what am I going to do today? Well, I think I'll go get some eggs Benedict, and I'll hit the golf course, maybe do some laps in the pool, have a nice dinner, Chateau Lafitte maybe. Then what? Go to a movie. Oh, let's jet to Los Angeles. See what's going on out there. And they can relieve all this pressure. They have all this. But are they happy? The removal of suffering doesn't necessarily bring happiness. Happiness comes from within. So, 8, this gift obviously demands a much greater level of emotional and personal involvement than some of the other gifts. This is obviously a much closer gift in that regard, I would think, that you have to get in there with the person and really, you're rubbing shoulders with them at a level and helping them carry their load. And I think people can sense that. 9, it is very possible that certain people will take advantage of one that is so caring and compassionate, and can inappropriately dominate the time of a believer with this gift. While you may be merciful, you also have to sometimes stop, step back, and say, now, wait a minute. Is this believer just dominating my time because they can? Because I'm letting them. And so, like other gifts, you sometimes have to learn how to say no. and pray about it. Obviously, again, you've got to be led by the Spirit, resident doctrine functioning, and all of that. And your gift will work. 10, it is important that those with the gift be discerning as to why certain people are suffering. One would not use his spiritual gift to provide aid and comfort to someone under God's discipline. You don't want to get between that person and God. If God's whacking them, as David said, you know, he's out there running along the road, and I can't remember who it was, but this guy's running and shouting and throwing rocks at him and calling him names and cursing him, and Joab says, "Hey, you want me to go over and take his head off?" David said, "No. Perhaps God has told him to do this. Perhaps God has told him to curse me." And David showed some real orientation to God's discipline in his life, because he was under discipline at that time. Well, you don't want to jump in there and try to alleviate that discipline necessarily. And so this is where you have to be careful with this gift. None of us, I don't think, again, normally in our right minds, we really don't like seeing people suffer, particularly people we love. And in that regard, I mean, you can sometimes take more offense for people you love than you would even take for yourself when they're suffering. You think, well, I mean, I've seen this in people. They will take greater offense sometimes for someone that's close to them than they would have even for themselves. You can do me wrong, but you better not do those around me that I love wrong, kind of mentality. So again, you want to pray about it and be careful and say, okay, look, I want to be merciful. I want to help people and help bear their burdens and shoulder the load with them. But if they're under discipline, I got to be kind of careful about that. I don't want God jamming me, that's for sure. Don't lay hands, what did Paul tell Timothy? Don't lay hands on any man suddenly, and thus share in the discipline of others. And obviously, I recognize that's an ordination verse and all of that for pastors, but by extension, I think it applies to certain other situations. You got to be careful. 11, however, this gift would be very important to those under reversion recovery, since they would likely be burdened with some lupe. If a person really goes out and blows it, and really makes huge spiritual mistakes, there's going to be some discipline associated with that. They're going to have to ride that out. Now, if they stay with doctrine and they stay under it and they continue to try to fight the good fight, they're going to ride that out. But you can see where a person with the gift of mercy could be very helpful to somebody who was suffering through some of this. Somebody who, had made decisions and people are withdrawing from them and won't talk to them and all of that. And at various levels, you got to, as each believer has to sort out what God wants from them in their niche. I've seen people pull some real spiritual stunts and then come back to a local church. I mean, stunts that you would cringe. And they come back to a local church. Now, there's a lot of issues involved here. If they come back and they are repentant under grace, you accept them. And fine. And you forgive and forget and move on. Now, that doesn't mean you got to socialize with them. That doesn't mean you got to talk to them. I mean, it does mean, you know, if they walk by, you don't spit on their shoes. You know, what are you doing here? Kind of mentality. But it doesn't mean you have to be friends with them at that level. And so a person comes back under that. There are a lot of people who are going to remain aloof. Because once you've been burned, you're a little more cautious about what all you engage in and who all you believe. And particularly if you observe somebody pull a major spiritual stunt, then you pull back from them. That's a natural thing. You become a little more cautious. And there's nothing wrong with being cautious. But you can see where a person with a gift of mercy can be very beneficial to that kind of person. If everybody withdraws from them, not separates, we're not talking about full-blown separation, but a person comes back and they pulled something and, you know, when they walk by and people say hi, and that's the extent of all they get. Hello, how are you? You can see where a person with a gift of mercy that would really get close to them could be very beneficial to help them get through a very difficult time. And not that we all don't necessarily have to do that. You have to play these things by ear. You have to figure it out as you go. Again, prayer is critical to all of this. I remember that when there was this particular situation where these people pulled a real stunt, and I was discussing it with another believer. I said, well, I'm just not inclined to socialize with them. I'm just not, I don't trust them at this point. Okay. I got the right under my priesthood not to trust somebody. particularly if they've reversed a position they've held historically, say for 20 years, then all of a sudden they're completely doing something just the opposite. That does tend to throw up a red flag with me. Okay, why are you doing the opposite now? This was right for 20 years. What suddenly changed? But as I told this guy, I said, I'm not inclined. I said, I feel uncomfortable being around these people, frankly. And I have the right to feel uncomfortable. I have the right to my own feelings. And he said, well, I just know, I think about if it was me. And I came back. I'd want somebody to, you know, that would talk to me and be with me and encourage me. And I could really see what he was saying. And I could see both sides of this thing. And I was like, well, yeah, I can see that. I can see where a person, say, with the gift of mercy would be very beneficial at that time. And not just at that time, but I cite this as a main example because we've all known people that have pulled stunts. And sometimes all they need is someone to help encourage them, to help them get through it, to get past the discipline and the lupe. And a person with this gift would be very beneficial in that regard. 12, those with this gift must be careful not to take offense for other believers, allowing themselves to be caught up in mental attitude sins or something worse. Let's say you had the gift of mercy. Somebody goes out and pulls a stunt and they come back to class. You could get very ticked off about the fact, well, people aren't associating with them. Well, that's their business, though, isn't it? You have to still allow for freedom of volition and other people to function under the privacy of their priesthood. And I'm not saying all of us do this perfectly or even appropriately sometimes. But if a person, you know, pulls a stunt and comes back, you're cordial, you're nice, that's all you really have to be. And at a certain level, they may need some time and space to sort things out on their own. And again, there's going to be a certain amount of discipline. God doesn't just look the other way because people do. That doesn't happen. So 13, since it is easy for a believer with this gift to fall into the trap of operating on emotion rather than doctrine, he should be very careful when dealing with single people of the opposite sex. In fact, I don't tend to recommend that situation at all. That you have to, in a one-on-one setting, unsupervised, whether you're married or not, people can quickly get the wrong idea about things. And you want to avoid the very appearance of evil. Now, I'm not freaky about this. Some people are. I have enough confidence and faith in God, and I know my own mental attitude. I mean, I don't just freak out, oh, I'm alone in a room with a woman. Ah! Some people do. They say, oh, man, that's the appearance of evil. No, it's not. Not necessarily. If you freak out about it, it is. But I don't necessarily freak out about it, but I try. You know, you would want to use some discernment and decorum and some caution in that regard. I would certainly not advise long-term anybody in a one-on-one setting counseling somebody of the opposite sex alone. I mean, not that there's never a place for that. I hate to make these blanket assertions because there could always be an exception to the rule. But I would say be very cautious and careful. And particularly if you're a caring, merciful person, it would be very easy for that person to develop an attachment to you under those situations. So, again, that's something you just have to watch for and be careful of. I don't tend to freak out. I know I'm, you know, that's not my deal. For some people, though, but an ongoing situation could develop into something you didn't plan on. So that we would counsel you to be very, very careful about. 14, this gift forms the inner parts of the body, the seat of the tender emotions. The Greek term splanchnon, the heart, stomach, bowels, the heartfelt emotions of mercy or compassion. All right, well, our time is up. We're going to stop there, and we will be ready to deal with Roman numeral 7 on Wednesday, recognizing and developing your gift. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.